You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to the latest Times Higher Education issue review podcast for the edition covering the 11th to the 17th of July 2013. My name is Chris Parr. I'm joined by writers Elizabeth Gibney and Matthew Rice, news editor Simon Baker and deputy news editor John Morgan. Coming up on today's podcast, the HE bill that never was. John Morgan on a new regulatory framework for HE that does not require new legislation. An announcement I think we're expecting today, John, is that right?
Yes, that's right. David Willetts is scheduled to make a written ministerial statement in the House of Commons, and this is basically going to be bringing together a regulatory framework for higher education in England under the new system. And this is to cover for the fact that there never was a higher education bill because of opposition from the Liberal Democrats, supposedly. And the lack of a bill created a bit of a regulatory black hole.
Very good. Well, then we'll hear a bit more about that in a second. We'll also be hearing from Matthew about what he learned when he met Harvard scholar and academic superstar Michael Sandel. Lizzie will be telling us a bit how one university is improving how it interacts with its local community. And I'll reveal a little bit more about the 10 truths your PhD supervisor will never tell you, which is our cover feature this week. But before all that, John, yeah, you were telling us this announcement from Willetts, filling a black hole left when the HE bill didn't arrive.
So this is about higher education regulation, which you might think could be filed under important but boring. But thanks to some very skillful editing from Simon, it's now exciting and even sexy in a way that I never imagined it could be.
Wow, I wouldn't say that.
Some of the key points are that the National Union of Students is going to be given a role in regulating England's universities alongside HEFCE. It seems significant that the NUS is the only body named alongside HEFCE in Mr. Willetts' letter to HEFCE. And also, in a very kind of wonkish point, he's decided on the mechanism that HEFCE is going to have to have sanction over universities and make them do what they need to do in terms of not recruiting too many students and meeting all the access agreements that they have to. So basically, instead of taking away grant, which it's not going to be able to do in the future because there isn't going to be any grant, HEFCE is going to have the ultimate sanction of taking away a university's permission to have its students eligible for publicly funded loans.
That's going to annoy some universities, presumably, if students won't be able to access that sort of state-funded loan.
I think that would really be the last resort, but HEFCE, and it's unlikely that it ever would happen, but HEFCE does need to have some kind of sanction to make universities do what it needs them to do. Otherwise, you know, it would just be chaos, and there won't be any proper accountability for public funding, so it's kind of the nuclear option.
Mm. I mean, what the problem was, I suppose, in some ways, is that without doing this, there was always a sort of a risk that quite a lot of universities would go, well, we don't get any money from HEFCE anymore. Why should I do what HEFCE tells me to do? I'm just going to go off and do, in fact, I might just go private completely. Why should I bother with the government anymore? And obviously that has all sorts of implications politically and in loads of other ways. So, you know, the government has been kind of very aware of this hanging around in the background, and they knew they had to do something about it, and they thought they'd have to change the law, but it looks like they've found another way around it, really.
Although this does sort of raise the possibility that some universities would be very unhappy about the government attaching conditions to tuition fees, which many universities would see as private funding and not something that the government should be controlling.
Now, an excellent piece, and we'll watch with interest to how that develops. Another story this week, though, Matthew, you recently met with Michael Sandel, a political philosopher and the professor of government at Harvard University. Before I ask you about your meeting, let's just hear a quick excerpt from that interview.
I think that we need to guard against the tendency, the tendency of financial pressures on universities to distort the academic values and the academic mission. I think we have to guard against this tendency in admissions, but also in the rules governing research, sponsored research, the relation between the university and the corporate world. So I think that higher education is increasingly becoming a flashpoint.
Right. So there are real dangers there.
Yes. And of course, universities are struggling financially and need to sustain themselves for the sake of their mission. But it's important that the financial pressures are not allowed to distort the fundamental purposes that universities serve and the academic values that universities
and
serve.
Do you think there are examples which it clearly has gone too far that people...
I think in the area of sponsored research, we have to be very careful.
Yes, that was Michael Sandel there, talking about the crossover between the corporate world and academia. But you covered a lot more ground in your interview, Matthew. How did this come around? It sounded like you were in a bar there, having a quiet drink. Was that the setting?
It was, yes. He was doing his tour of Britain to promote his book, What Money Can't Buy, which is essentially a critical examination of the whole neoliberal philosophy of life, where money can buy everything, prisoners can get upgrades in prisons if they pay enough, and schools are plastered all over with corporate branding and so on. And the paperback's just out, and he was in Britain giving a tour, so he was staying in a nice hotel, and he found
which money can buy, of course.
Which money can buy, yes. So we met in the bar, but. Yes, just before lunch, so it wasn't too loud. But
so, what was he like? An interesting chap to meet.
Well, he's a very interesting man, very compelling man, very patient. I think he's probably got his story pretty straight. He's now been interviewed hundreds and hundreds of times, so you're never going to catch him out. And I mean, he's a very strong critic of the commercialization of universities and of education, and the sort of neoliberal approach. And certainly he's obviously at Harvard, and there's certainly questions about how what role universities, the elite universities of the world, have played in the sort of neoliberal consensus and the banking crisis and all the rest of it. He was clear what his views are. And but if you say, well, you know, what's it like at your university, kind of thing, it was all came up with rather bland responses. We have to be careful about these things, and so on. He's a very compelling man. I mean, the other thing that's interesting is he teaches at an elite university. He teaches very much a sort of traditional course on justice, with going back to Aristotle and Immanuel Kant and John Stuart Mill. And this has now become a sort of sensation all over the world, because his introductory course is now available for free online and has been taken up just about everywhere. And that, of course, raises the question about why you need institutions like Harvard if people can get all the same stuff for free. And again, his reply was slightly evasive, but this is perhaps not totally surprising.
And you can make sense of all his baseball analogies.
Yes, he is rather obsessed with baseball, and at one point he talks about that now the rich are up in skyboxes and the poor are down in the stadium. People don't rub shoulders on the way to buy their hot dogs anymore. And his word for all that's gone wrong in the world is skyboxification. It's probably a word we don't need. So there's a bit too much about his passion for baseball to my taste in the book, but it is a very interesting and compelling book nonetheless.
Yes, it is, and an interesting and compelling interview as well, I'm pleased to say. So,
thank you.
Yes, do check that out. Lizzie, bringing a bit closer to home, we're all familiar with the idea that a good university should be very much at the heart of its local community. You've been hearing about one particularly successful scheme in this area.
Yeah, this is a community university partnership programme at the University of Brighton, and I think it's really interesting to take an in-depth look at the project as we do in this piece, because everyone talks at the moment about knowledge transfer and about how much universities can contribute to UK PLC and to the country, but they rarely think about the social impact that they can have, and especially, I mean, we had loads of civic universities that were set up essentially to be part of that community. And in this project, what they've done, this has lasted about over 10 years now, and 5 years ago they won one of our awards for outstanding contribution to the community. And they, it's very simple. They have the help desk, so people in the community can come to them and say, I've got this project, this idea, do you have someone who I can talk to about getting it off the ground? But it's now ended up not just being interaction with academics, but it's with students. And in fact, I think every student now at the university has to have some kind of community engagement as part of their course. So there's all sorts of things. It's creating policy for the city. There was an academic who was involved with creating the city's traveller policy. It's working with students with learning disabilities and using art as not just something to keep them busy during a day while they're in care, but actually as something that, you know, they can progress, and some of the works have ended up in Tate Modern, you know, it's amazing. So it just kind of shows the breadth of different ways in which universities can work with their communities in a way that I can't see them doing enough, as far as I'm concerned, around the country.
Interesting when you look at the directions some universities go to stay relevant, I guess. Is that one way is to look more globally, we've got to compete on the world stage. But another way is very much to look, you know, to where you are, where you're situated, the things you can do that no other university could do because they're not located in the heart of that community. So it's really interesting to hear where these sort of schemes are being really successful.
I think what was fascinating about this project for me is, I suppose Lizzie's already sort of touched on this, but often just knowledge transfer and how universities engage with the community is all about making money and all about growth and all about sort of real actual economic value. Well, here's a kind of quite clear example of some social value being created by what a university does. It's quite an impressive sort of project, and it's good to look at a project like this in detail, because I think often with kind of any social community projects, you know, it's very difficult, it's impenetrable often to see beyond some of the kind of vague descriptions of the project that you often read. But to actually look at something in detail that has got real examples of where it's making a difference, I think it's really interesting.
And the point is, most of the time these cost absolutely nothing, and it's of benefit to the students themselves. People, for instance, on the pharmacy course, they've been working with elderly people who often take their medication wrong. So it's on one side, the elderly people get, you know, they end up taking their medication properly, and the other side, students who are working, trained to become pharmacists, are actually having that hands-on experience right at the beginning of their course. So it benefits everyone. That's the real point.
And it's good to shout about these projects from time to time, and I think the feature, your article, I should say, this week very much does that. Before we go, I did promise that we'd reveal a little bit about our cover feature entitled 10 Truths Your PhD Supervisor Will Never Tell You. It's written by Tara Brabazon, or Brabazon, I'm not actually sure on that. I probably should have checked before we started this podcast.
It's Brabazon.
Brabazon, thank you, Matthew. Who wrote...
I could phone her right now.
Who wrote one of the most popular pieces on our website of all time, which was How Not to Write a PhD Thesis. That's still up there and very amusing to look at. But I will reveal one of them very quickly, of these 10 truths your supervisor will never tell you. Number two is you choose a supervisor. Do not let the institution overrule your choice. Some sound advice. But I thought John Morgan, as the only PhD-er sat around this table, I thought I'd ask if there's anything from your PhD days that sort of stick in your mind around this issue.
Well, I particularly agreed with one point made in the piece, that supervisors should be functional humans.
That's a bit much to ask.
Well, I thought I'd known some very good robots that are very good supervisors.
It's not a very academic point, but I do think it's really important to have a supervisor who you're able to get on with and able to form a good functioning relationship with. I won't say that, you know, you and your supervisor is as intimate as going out with someone, but it's probably getting somewhere near that.
You're spending a lot of time with them.
Exactly.
Are you sure you want to tell us any more about your days as a PhD?
No. It was an entirely professional relationship, and sort of very, very happy with the supervisor I had. And I think being able to have, you know, a good, strong relationship on a personal as well as an academic level was really helpful. And when I had the Viva, and there was quite a prickly external examiner who maybe was not the most receptive or understanding. It was very good to have my supervisor fighting my corner. So I think that relationship can be really important.
Sounds like there's a lot of PhD students who would be jealous of the fact that you did see your supervisor quite a lot.
Yes,
that's
indeed.
Probably true.
That's always the case.
Yeah, well, do check out our Twitter feed as well, because we started a hashtag PhD Truths, which has already taken off like wildfire, as a lot of our PhD topics do on Twitter. I'm sure they're very busy, but they always seem to find time to take part in that, for which we're very glad. But yeah, you can, of course, discuss anything we've discussed in this podcast on our Twitter feed. You'll find us on Facebook, on LinkedIn, you'll find us on Google+, you'll find us at timeshighereducation.co.uk, and we'll be back next week with another Times Higher Education issue review podcast.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.